if literature saves lives, it saved mine. I don't write expecting my work to save anybody. But my hope is that the novel and the poem is an architecture in which we can find communion through differences.
Herzlich willkommen zu Hansa Rauschen, dem Literaturpodcast des Hansa Verlages. Mein Name ist Florian Kessler. Hier sprechen alle zwei Wochen Lektorinnen und Lektoren mit Menschen aus der Welt der Bücher, mit Schreibenden und Lesenden, mit Leuten von anderen Verlagen und aus dem Haus. Es geht um alles, was in Bücher passt und außenrum passiert. Und das ist wirklich nicht wenig. Lass mich von vorn anfangen. Mit diesem kleinen Satz beginnt Ocean Wangs Roman Auf Erden sind wir kurz grandios, in der Übersetzung von Anne-Christine Mittag. Das Buch ist 2019 im Original in den USA bei Penguin und in Deutschland bei Hansa erschienen und wurde von Anfang an sehr viel und sehr begeistert gelesen und diskutiert. Ocean Wang, 1988 in Saigon in Vietnam geboren, kam im Alter von 2 Jahren in die USA. Er wurde zuerst mit seiner Lyrik bekannt, darunter die Gedichtsammlung Night Sky with Exit Wounds, ehe dann On Earth We Are Briefly Gorgeous erschien, dieser Brief an eine Mutter, die Analphabetin ist und diesen Brief niemals lesen wird. Jetzt gerade im September war Ocean in Deutschland und stellte zum ersten Mal überhaupt vor internationalem Publikum seinen Roman vor. Vor einem dieser Lesungsereignisse sprach er für unseren Podcast im Hotel in Hamburg mit seinem Lektor bei Hansa, Piero Salabé. Über das Buch und seine Hintergründe, über das Schreiben und seine Möglichkeiten, über Literatur als einen für alle gemeinsam betretbaren Ort der Freiheit. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
So, Ocean, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to talk
to
you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
After your book has been published, there have been so enormous reactions from all over the place. Mm. And so we feel honored to have you here in Germany for the first time for presenting your book in several cities. One is Hamburg and the other one will be Berlin mm-hmm. tomorrow. You can feel free to ask anything. It's not only on the book, it's just a conversation, just to talk with you about anything, mm-hmm. basically. Well, is this really the first time you're in Germany, Ocean?
The second time. Yeah, so, the first time I was 17, going through on a train, I visited Italy, Germany, and France. On a Europe pass.
You were one of those Americans
one
coming
those,
with the Europe pass.
Yeah. So. And I regret not knowing how to look at the world when I was 17. I blew past it, moving from one place to another, just looking for a good slice of pizza. Something I could have gotten in New York. So that was the boy who went through Europe. And
so what was your impression of Germany, or let's say the German-speaking countries at that time?
You know, the most memorable thing is that I was eating pretzels.
Yeah.
But I couldn't, nobody had mustard. And so the only word I knew was Haben Sie Senf? and nobody had mustard. I couldn't believe it, you know. And I just thought, oh God, isn't this where like everybody eats pretzels? But maybe only in New York they eat it with mustard. I don't know. But that was my only recollection.
I see.
You know, so I'm really happy to be back with a more, deep gaze.
Yes.
Of the world, and it's been an absolute pleasure. And also, I've read more German literature. Since then, and I can see the world of Siebold and Kafka, Rilke, Muertehüller, and it's been beautiful to see.
You know? Yes, yeah. Your book is, which just came out in Germany with the title "Auf Erden sind wir kurz grandios." In English, it's "On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous." The form you take is a letter written to a mother. Mm. Has this any relationship with authors you have read?
Yeah, it was the big influence was Marilynne Robinson's Gilead, and that book was a novel. A pastor writes to his son, right, who's still living, and I thought it was such a great form because the letter allows for divergences. the parentheticals, dead ends. You can depart from the plot and go anywhere. It was basically the best form to write the essayistic inquiries. And I wanted my novel to have those. But the one that really sealed that mode was Kafka's Dearest Father.
Oh, Brief an den Vater. Oh,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's interesting because it's not a book, it's not a publication, it's not literature to his eyes. He wrote it and his father never read it. And the impossibility of the confession, the confrontation, and ultimate vulnerability was what was so powerful to me about that text. And I read it as literature. You know, I didn't know any better. I saw the book in a used bookstore next to Metamorphosis, next to The Trial. Mm-hmm. And I read it as literature. Yeah. And I learned from it as literature. And I thought, what urgency and how timeless, in a way, how undying is the child writing to the parent. That is the core of communication. That is the ultimate first act.
Yes.
You say ma and pa. you that's the first moment you learn speech is with your parents. And what an incredible mode to now speak to them when you have all the words you need, when you have what a little dog calls a belly full of English, you know.
Mm. Yeah. And this addressing to the mother, and you have some poems in your book that will be published next year in Germany, Night Sky with Exit Wounds, Nachthimmel mit Austrittswunden, that's the German title. You have also several poems addressed to the father.
Yeah.
And then there is also this beautiful, beautiful prayer for the newly damned.
Yeah.
Again, this addressing to the father, the parents, as some protective figure. Yes. Mm-hmm. Can we see it this way?
Yeah, a protective figure, a figure who might not even be there. And I think that was one of the impulses of the Book of Poems, which is to mythologize a father who was barely real, which is the power of literature. Mm. If you do not know it, make it up, right? And the big credo in American writing workshops is write what you know. Mm. And I wanted to write what I didn't know for the Book of Poems. And it felt like a powerful beginning of a writer's life to have to invent the most intimate figure in anybody's life, which is a father. And I didn't really know my father.
Mm.
So I had to make him up. And to make him up in the same way, I think that's why I lean on classical references, classical Greek references, because Homer wrote the Trojan War nearly 300 years after its supposed epicenter, right? So he's creating an entire fiction out of a reality. And I felt, wow, what if I did the same? What if I also created a fiction out of my reality? And I gave the father a lot of room in the poems. But in Honor for Blitzy Gorgeous, I want to give the mother room.
Yes.
You know, I wanted them to have their own stages.
Mm.
Because in life, they didn't want to be on the same stage. You know, they left each other. So I wanted to respect that and give them their own time.
As readers of your novel, one is curious about what the relationship between the autobiographical aspect and the fictional aspect is. Right. So you were saying that Kafka's letter was addressed to a difficult father who didn't even read it.
Right.
In your case, we would be intrigued to know, is this mother real or is it a fictional mother?
Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, I wanted to invite the autobiographical reading. I think it was important not to I could have put the same characters in ancient Vietnam, medieval Europe, but I wanted them to be situated in a world that I knew intimately, as a way of saying that this is a map of an artist's coming of age, that he came of age and came to the literary table with these roots, to have such a mother, to have an immigrant refugee epicenter, to live in working class New England, a place where you don't think working class people exist. You know, the great mythology is that New England is a place of wealth, of the first colonizers. It's a rich, you know, legacy of power. And that's true, but there's also a great diverse group of immigrants who make New England possible. And it was my chance to take a subordinate milieu and focus on them as a central place in literature. And I think this is the impulse a lot of artists have done, to turn the autobiographical mode as the site of a subordinate caste and make dignity and respect from that place. You know, when Melville wrote Moby Dick, he was writing out of a subordinate position to British literature, which was deemed as supreme, superior, and real, more real than New England literature, which is why he turned his gaze inward. It was about New England life, and it's an autobiographical novel. People rarely read it as such, but it is. Melville lived that life. And the same goes with Baldwin's Go Tell It to the Mountain. He said, I had to write that book in order to write any other book. Toni Morrison's first book, The Bluest Eye. This mode that the Bildungsroman, the coming of age, for someone coming out of a subordinate class of the national fabric, is also a Kunstlerroman, which is the artist's novel. And I thought that was a great opportunity, that I wanted to articulate my people as a place and a milieu that helped me see the world. I did not arrive at the literary table by escaping them, by transcending the working class. I arrived because of it. I arrived here because they taught me how to see and recognize beauty. And when your body is broken in factories, nail salons, when you are nearly obliterated by work and labor, you learn to privilege beauty and to recognize beauty in your life. And so I think that's why I wanted to create a fiction, to create an imagination out of the real context. I did not want to write a memoir or to be a historian, because that would involve creating an ultimate truth for these people. And I did not want to be a representative or a spokesperson for this milieu. I wanted to say only that they informed my thinking as an artist. But I did not want to say this is how they lived in the world, which is why it was important that the foundation, the context of the book is real, the foundation of a house, you know, if you will. But the rest of the book, the windows, the colors, what goes into it, what happens inside that home, was the act of the imagination for me.
There is a line in your book which is very impressive, where, in fact, you talk about visiting libraries and reading books in this library. Mm-hmm. And I just would like to read this beautiful sentence. How I fled my shitty high school to spend my days in New York, lost in library stacks, reading obscure texts by dead people, most of whom never dreamt a face like mine floating over their sentences, and least of all, that those sentences would save me. Mm-hmm. So, how... did that work, that a person coming from your background, a working class background, apparently, we don't know, maybe it's fiction, but in the book, the mother cannot read English, doesn't really know well the language. How has literature come into that life?
Right. I think one of the things I wanted to show was that a Bildungsroman was also something that could have a history, a prehistory. In the tradition of the coming-of-age novel in America, seminal texts like J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, Sylvia Plath's Bell Jar, the coming-of-age happens in a very small, limited scope of time, often within a few weeks or a few months, you know, in Salinger's case, a few days, and they're ejected into college or adulthood, but they have no history. There's no, you know, before. Even in Salinger's case, he even mentions, his narrator says, I could tell you about where I come from and all that, but that's boring, right? And so it's interesting to me, coming from a refugee background, that I think it's a great privilege to deem your history boring. It comes from a place of privilege that Salinger had, you know. And I wanted to write an American Bildungsroman that did have a prehistory. And one of the opportunities of doing that is that I showed that literature for me began with the oral tradition, with the women who raised me, and the storytelling that they
possessed. Was it an American? Was it an American or was it Vietnamese, what you listened to, this oral tradition?
It's a Vietnamese tradition, yeah. You know. And you realize that for refugee women to tell a story in America, in Hartford, meant that they had to use their bodies as libraries, as archives. And they had to decide which stories to leave out of their memory and which to keep. And so not only do you have a library, but you have a curated library, and one that is constantly changing. Every rendition of a story changes. Every detail changes. And I learned right away that that was freedom, that what the women in my family were doing was creating stories out of freedom. They were making it up when their memory faltered, or even when they're bored, they'll just change the story. And so my acknowledgement and encounter with literature began there. So by the time I arrived at the library, I already knew that stories was a site of power and the site of agency. So when Little Dog reads in the library, the way I myself read in the library, I realized that the writers who wrote those books did not have to imagine me. Most likely they didn't. They did not have to imagine me for me to find what they made useful, right? And that's the great power of being a reader, is that you come to terms and you harvest what's useful to you, even if the author never dreamed you, right? And this proves, you know, Roland Barthes' theory of the death of the author. Not only were the authors I read actually dead, but their agency was vanished after they wrote the text, because I encountered it with my own power. And I could be saved, quote unquote, by the sentences and the things that they wrote, even if they never dreamed me into existence, in the same way I was saved by Emily Dickinson, Whitman, you know, these folks who never dreamed, just as I was saved by folks who might have dreamed me, like Baldwin, Toni Morrison, and Lee Young Lee, writers who might have imagined me and who equally helped me along the way.
When you write and you expose this optimism in literature, being able to rescue, to save lives. Do you think that this is something which in our time is not too optimistic?
Yeah, I don't know if literature saves lives. It saves mine. I don't write expecting my work to save anybody. But my hope is that the novel and the poem is an architecture in which we can find communion through differences. And in this sense, I feel that at my best, whether I'm writing a poem or a novel, I'm creating a town square, or what the Italian, the piazza, which is something very common in Europe, but very, very rare in America. America did not construct itself around the piazza. It constructed itself around the main street, which is a place of commerce. And maybe, in fact, it might be very un-American to write as a way of creating a town square. But I wanted to create a place in a landscape where anybody can inhabit and encounter each other, encounter these characters, and then carry on. You know, I did not want to trap them into the space or force a reader to feel anything, but only to create the conditions and the architecture in which they might think and inquire alongside me.
There is a very enormous scene in your book which takes place in a Baptist church. There are people from Dominican origin, I think also from Cuba, and the priest has, I think, preachers about the Noah's Ark. You say Noah?
Noah's Ark.
And then there is this extraordinary moment where the mother in the book is singing, using what you were mentioning before, addressing her father, I think. That scene, the reader perceives that strong communal moment. Is that something, and it's a, you know, it's a praise of the song, the singing, being able to connect people, to bring all the people in the ark. Is that
right?
Is that a metaphor of literature?
Yes, for me, for sure. That the myth of Noah's Ark haunted me even before I became a writer, certainly after I became a writer. In a way, it's a thesis that informs a lot of my work. Is I don't write expecting or planning on writing another book. You know, if it comes, I hope it comes. That would be beautiful and wonderful. But I see every project in the way Noah saw his ark, which is to put everything that is important for you, that you hope to see in the future, that survives an apocalypse. What would I want to know of myself after the great wreck, after the great flood, and whether it's figuratively or real? When you have that charge, then every sentence must count. Every idea must matter. And it was a great teaching moment to me as a technician to craft my work, allowing only the most useful things to enter the vessel of the novel. And that moment of communion is incredibly haunting to me, in that in the space of great difference, the church was where so many different people congregated. You know, it's called a congregation. And through song, we could forget briefly
the differences.
The differences. And
the Holy Spirit, is it going through the people?
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe in the spiritual romanticized tradition of it, but only in the very practical sense that when folks in the church sang, the way I saw it, the way I witnessed it as a child, they were allowed to abandon social mores, social etiquette. They could shout, they could scream, they could
become someone else,
be angry, you know, become someone else or more of themselves. You know, they can embody other truths that you couldn't embody at the supermarket. You couldn't embody at your job as a law clerk, you know, when you had to perform certain things. And the church was where, in this brief moment of the praise break, you could abandon so many things. And I think that was where Little Dog's mother could abandon even motherhood, where she could be a child again. She could ask of her father, "Where are you?" Where she could be utterly a child, and she didn't have to be a mother anymore. And I think that was, the song was an agent, a medium that allowed her to become more of herself.
Along with this longing for communal moments of transcendence, even maybe, it is very strong in the book, the story of grief that is passed from one to the next generation. In fact, the protagonist, Little Dog, is the grandchild of war. I wanted to ask you, how do you, as an American, you're an American, and there are some autobiographical links with your own history. How do you consider the American identity related to that particular page of history? And I would like to link it, since you are here in Germany, to what people in this country, and especially writers, have experienced after the tragedy and the trauma of the Second World War, being the Germans, the perpetrators of evil, of maybe the blackest page of human history, which has accompanied the history and also the literature of Germany for such a long time, from Günter Grass to Heinrich Boll to the even mentioned Siebold, who wrote a book, you know, Austerlitz, about the, you know, long-term consequence of that trauma. It's obviously completely different. You cannot compare, I think, National Socialism to what the Americans did in Vietnam. All the same, there is this dealing with a trauma that passed, that does not pass, that even generations after is still there. The Germans, even this state of Germany, in the words of its former foreign secretary, Joschka Fischer, said Auschwitz is the founding stone of this country, which means our own identity is an identity, or should be an identity, which contains the conscience of violence, evil, and grief. And this is something revolutionary in some kind, being nationalism, the contrary, the celebration of, you know, all that things. How is, for you being, well, it's not you, it's, of course, Little Dog, the child, the grandchild of war, at the same time being an American?
I love that quote from the ambassador that you mentioned, Fischer, because what that quote is that it's a sobering reckoning with a nation's epicenter. And within that darkest page, the response, Fischer's response to that darkest chapter in European history, is a moment of hope, because it's what she's saying It's a she?
It's a he. It's
he.
A he. Yoshka, yes.
What he's saying is that we will not forget where we come from.
That's the hope.
That's the hope, you know. And I think that that is still ahead of American memory. Because if Americans thought that way, we would have never had the credo of make America great again. That credo is incredibly irresponsible because it purports memory, but is in fact nostalgia. Because when you ask the follow-up, when was America great? The answer is elusive. It pretends to remember, but in fact it is nostalgia, which is the parody of memory without remembering at all. In fact, it's amnesia. And I think we are still have not, as a country, really asked what have we become out of violence, that we began as a nation out of genocide, Native American genocide, and then slavery, and then wars, right? Vietnam being only one of them, invasions, imperialism. We haven't asked that, and I think part of it is mythos, Roland Barthes' mythologies, where he talks about a national mythos is one of the greatest dangers in that it can convince the next generation that it is flawless, that it defends freedom. If you look at a commercial for the Marines in America, and those commercials come every evening when you're watching football or sports or a TV show, the word freedom comes up in service of a commercial to get young people to enlist in the military. And it's fantastical. You have a man or a woman or a person on a mountain dressed in ceremonial soldier's garb with a sword, and they are brave, courageous, or they're heroic, right? The hero. So America still sees itself as a hero. And meanwhile, the taxes that its citizens pay go towards weaponry that in fact leads to innocent lives destroyed in the Middle East and Afghanistan, now going on nearly 20 years. So that reckoning has never happened because the documentation was so poor. And I think the difference between America and Germany is that German documentation, European documentation of World War II and the Holocaust and Auschwitz was so thorough. We have the Primo Levis, we have the Elie Wiesel et al. And the memory was not lost. Propaganda was not allowed to take over. The Holocaust museums in Washington, D.C., the Holocaust Museum is the most popular museum. When it comes to the crimes, what many call the first in Genesis crimes of America, this initial sin, that is still elusive. That documentation is still shaky. You know, I went to visit the plantations in New Orleans, outside of New Orleans. And only recently, in the past 6 years, did any of the plantation, and it turns out only one plantation, address slavery. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
Before 6 years ago, in what is called the Whitney Plantation, you can visit the plantations, but they'll never talk about slavery. They'll talk about architecture. You know, people, oh, what kind of molding is it happened here? So people would go and look at the architecture where slaves lived and not talk about slavery, you know. And so the way we remember in the States is still thin, that amnesia is still fraught, because America as a country, I think, unlike Germany, because Germany has a history before World War II. It had the Napoleonic Wars. It had a history of that came after the Roman Empire and the Roman Catholicism. It has, you know, a rich, dense history of complications before Hitler. But America did not. Its very history, the ground zero, at least as a nation, began with colonialization. And from that came a great mythos of Western expansion and progress. So freedom, manifest destiny, was part and parcel with its first identity. We the people, right? That's the Declaration of Independence. But people is selective, right? Right away, it was selective. And so to uphold that false dream requires amnesia. If you remember too thoroughly as an American, you start to unravel your very identity. And which that's why I think we are so uneasy with it. And it takes refugees. It takes folks outside of the hegemonic milieu, like Baldwin, Toni Morrison, Viet Thanh Nguyen, to be able to remember America better. And I think that's one of my tasks that I hope to do as a writer, is to remember more thoroughly. Not to incriminate, not to create a polarization or even a list of crimes. You know, those lists are well documented. Historians have done that very well. My task is to remember more.
Have you seen Apocalypse Now for sure?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Did you like that film? Do you think it's a contribution, that sense of remembering more?
I thought it was important. But it was still important for whom, right? And it was seen as radical because it portrayed the brutality of American involvement to Americans, right? It was basically holding the mirror up to white Americans as a way of saying, look what you did, shame on you. It was much more brutal than the heroism and the false narratives that it fed its own. For the Vietnamese, we already knew that. We already knew it was horrific. And in fact, I've seen Vietnamese refugees who've seen that film and talked to Vietnamese refugees who've seen the film, who had panic attacks, who had absolute horrific PTSD episodes in the opening scene where the helicopters came in and literally just destroyed Vietnamese bodies. And they said, oh, I don't need to see that. I saw this already. So Apocalypse Now was a remedy to American, white American amnesia. But it did not acknowledge Vietnamese experience, Vietnamese American experience.
Right? Is there any artwork of artists, of American artists, who have acknowledged that better, in your opinion?
I think Mai Linh's memorial, the memorial wall. Now, of course, it doesn't have any Vietnamese names on it. But the fact that a memorial to an American war begins in the ground, it was very controversial when it came. But to me, it was one of the most faithful enactments of memory of that war, which is that it began subterranean, that the wall does not breach sea level. It's buried. And you encounter the wall almost by a surprise. When you walk up to it, you see the ground, and then the ground falls out, and then the wall is just this black shard that just opens up. You almost gasp at it, and I think that was an Asian American, a Chinese American woman, had a clearer recollection of what an American war was, that it was not a moment of glory. It was a moment of failure. It was a moment of interment, that it was burying, a burial. And that was a nice start. You know, of course, it doesn't acknowledge the cost of Vietnamese lives. But for Americans to participate in that war as a black mirror, to see their own faces, to see the names of their dead buried underground, which is the absolute antithesis to the pinnacles, the peaks, the phallic structures that we see in Washington, was an incredible, faithful moment of memory.
In your case, you moved, I think, from Vietnam to the States at the age of 2, is mm-hmm. that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So you couldn't have experienced it yourself, obviously, of course, because you were born much later. So this telling of it has a strong indirect way. Is it due to family memories or things you have felt within your surrounding or just, yes, growing? Or is it something imagined? There is this obviously big aspect we have in German literature. Can I tell something which I haven't lived?
Yeah.
Can I invent this?
Right.
Is it legitimate?
Right. The war scenes were few. There was only one, really. One war scene at the checkpoint. The Dodd.
Were they influenced by Apocalypse Now, by the film?
No. They were influenced by stories, Vietnamese accounts within my family, within communities, extended families I asked, research, my own research. But the war scenes were very few, and I wanted that. It was purposeful. I did not want to write my version of the war. It was not my place. I didn't live through it. But also, I could have, but it didn't excite me. You know, I was more interested in the aftermath, in what happens now. You know, and I think one of my impulses in writing this book, or any book, is to not write out of rage or anger. I don't think anger is useful to me as a thinker. It's useful to some of my friends, some of my heroes, write out of anger, write eloquently out of anger. I'm more interested in the aftermath of anger, which is care. After you rage, maybe you throw something, you're on the floor, but then you have to get up from the floor. You have to feed yourself, feed your children, feed your cats, pay your bills. You have to care, self-care. That is a more useful place to think for me, is the aftermath of anger, which is care. I'm more useful and powerful when I ask what now, rather than saying fuck you. You know, it's better to me to ask what now. And I think the novel comes out of that question. What now, as an American who comes out of war, as an American who exists because of war? Without that war, my mother wouldn't be born, I wouldn't be born. My father, my grandfather is an American soldier. I would not exist. I owe my life to the war, and yet the war is horrific. So that paradox is a site of agency and power for me, is to ask this question that has no answer. But in the asking, in the essay, which is the French essayer, which is to try, in the great attempt, that is where I feel most alive, which is to say, now what? We're already here. We can't look back and say, too bad, or that shouldn't have happened. Sure, we can say that, but it does nothing to change it. Saying that Auschwitz shouldn't happen does nothing to change the fact that it happened and it was horrific. Saying Vietnam shouldn't happen does nothing to change the fact that millions of lives were lost. It's more exciting to me to say, where do we go from here? And that's what I asked.
One of the most striking aspects of your book is the form it has. The form it wants to express what you just talked about war. So you were talking to me before and telling me that the novel was born during a thunderstorm in Italy.
Yes.
And then you added how you came to give it form by an episode you also experienced in Italy.
Yeah, I owe a lot to the Italians.
Yes, what happened? When was the moment when you said, this is the form I want to give it, this essayistic particular form?
I owe a lot to the Italians. Arianna Fallaci, she has this great letter to an unborn child. Mm. Calvino, Invisible Cities, The Fragmentation. Natalia Ginzburg, Primo Levi. Italian writers who really lay the foundation to think about war for me. And it was also, the Italian open negotiation of time that led to me writing the novel in a thunderstorm, because the Italian groundskeeper that was supposed to fix the electricity in the castle that I was staying at didn't show up right away. And so I thought, oh my God, if I'm going to write anything, I better write it by hand. Because if I wait for them, this residency might be over.
Yeah.
I was in a residency in Umberto. It might be over by the time the power comes back on. So I started it there. And then I went to Milan to read from the poem for the Milanesia Festival. And at the Palazzo Reale in Milan. And after reading, my host led me into a section of the palace that was unfurbished, unrefurbished.
Yeah. Why?
It was not restored. And then they led me into this great ballroom. And it was beautiful. It was dark, no lights. The light was coming through outside in these stained glass windows. And it was beautiful, but haunted. It was not a place to entertain guests, and I saw huge cracks on the wall, the paint crumbling, the roof tiles falling down. And I turned to them, I said, why are you showing me this? This looks like something that's under construction. I did not know. And my host said, this is a special portion of the palace that was bombed by the American air raids during World War II. And the people of Milan voted against refurbishing this wing because we did not want to forget what happened to us. We wanted to keep the wounds as they are. And I thought it was so incredible way to look at history. Because the impulse, when we look at history, particularly with art and museum, is to refurbish, to restore the original, to make it as it was. But when we do that, we erase the violent acts that made the breaking and the fracture possible. We choose amnesia, often without knowing it. We think, oh, it's our duty to restore this pot, this vase, this statue, this wing of the palazzo. It's the palace. It's the place of royalty. It's a place of national pride. Oh, we must restore it. But it's even more powerful for people to say no. We must show the next generation exactly what the older generation saw the day after the bombings, so they cannot forget. And I thought, my God, what would happen if I wrote a novel this way? A novel that works as a site of fracture, not a site of repair. Often we think of the novel as even a novel that comes out of trauma and war as a cohesive narrative, something that must have an arc. But when we do that, we're curating an experience. We become ushers into a theater rather than makers of trauma. You know, we put on the usher's coat and we say, right this way, sir and madam. Here's your seat. Enjoy the show. And when we refuse that, when we refuse to have a beautiful plot, a beautiful triumphant plot, a beautiful clean narrative arc with a denouement, a climax and a denouement, when we refuse that, we do what, you know, your fellow Italians did in Milan, which is to say, no, this is not a beautiful story. This is one where you can only dream of the original. The original is a ghost that you will not have because it was destroyed by violence and American bombs. We will not give you the original. We will not give you the perfect dream. We will not, because we don't have it ourselves. We have refused the dream ourselves in favor of the nightmare. And that was a powerful moment for me to, as a novelist, to think of form. So this novel begins in pieces. It begins in recollections, in the same way one encounters a shipwreck, one encounters debris. The novel begins with vignettes, just like a ship encountering a debris. If you come to a ship that's been destroyed, you encounter it in pieces. Time, the beginning of the ship or the end of the ship, encounters all over the place. Time is reconfigured. And that was thanks to my encounter with the Palazzo.
Yes. Is there any filmic also reference to your way of writing? In the sense of, you know, Marguerite Duras, essayistic films, yes, yes. And many others.
Yeah, Duras for sure. But film in general. Film as a medium informed not only the novel, but the poems. Because when you film something, you film it at the end of the film, you may film right away. The creation of film happens out of time. It happens non-linearly. And film is ultimately the art of montage, the art of editing. You know, film, the magic of film happens at the producer's desk. You know, the director can get multiple takes, but the vision happens in the formulation of the montage, piecing it together, the collage.
And that's how you worked as well?
That's how I worked. Yeah. I worked in pieces, and I orchestrated tension through proximity. Yeah. You know, putting one scene after another through the fissure, through the cracks along the wall that I saw in the Palazzo. That was how meaning was made. And so I wrote in piecemeal. I wrote in segments, and then I orchestrated it together. But that was how a collection of poems comes together. And you're a poet, you know how to order a manuscript. Is ordering pieces. Is working with rubble, really.
Has your mother read this book, or has it been read to her?
She knows about it, but, you know, it might be too painful for her.
Oh, really?
You know, it's, and I think I want to respect that this book, you know, I don't want to say that this book is for Vietnamese Americans. It's for anybody who wants to encounter it, because it's a painful book, and sometimes when you live through it, you shouldn't be forced to relive it if you don't want to, you know? And so I don't think every Asian American or every Vietnamese refugee should read it. If they don't want to, they don't have to. It's just there. But it's okay, you know? I actually prefer it. Beyond that, my family has very little interest in my career as a novelist. And it's a beautiful thing because it comes from their roots within the working class. They say, what are you? What do you do? You know?
But they are happy that you're...
They're very proud.
You can make a living.
Absolutely.
Out of it.
Okay. Very proud. Don't get me wrong. Very proud. They go to my readings.
Okay.
You know, they share the news with those they know, but they're not interested. Mm-hmm. you know, and I think it's good that they don't have to be. It's the interest of the middle class, right? The middle class says, wow, you have, your son is a novelist, you must care. You, this is a great thing. And they say, we don't know what it is. Sure, it seems important, but we're more concerned about, you know, our bills. We're more concerned, you know, I was accepted by the New Yorker for the first time.
Yeah.
Very prestigious, every writer's dream. And I didn't have anybody to really, you know, say it to. You don't want to call up your friend who's a writer, because then you're just rubbing it in their face, you know? I'm like, I got into New Yorker, how about you? You know, so you can't really call anybody. So I called my mom. I said, Mom, I got into the New Yorker. And she looked at me, I can hear her pausing on the phone. She says, you got into the New Yorker, but don't you already live in New York? What do you mean you're in New York? You've been living there for 6 years. What do you mean you got... Do you need any pickles? I can send you some pickles, you know. And I said, yes, send me pickles. Never mind, you know. So it was very humbling and refreshing that something I'm excited about, they don't care. And it's okay, you know. Why should they? Why should something that the middle class cultural milieu, you know, place at the center, why should that be anybody else's center? Why should that be the working class center if they don't want it to be? You know, and so it was lovely, I think, for them to say, whatever.
Has your mother given you your name, Ocean?
Yeah.
So it was her decision?
Yeah, and it sounds much more exotic than it is, you know. The word ocean in Vietnamese is hai.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very common name. Hai is very common. It's not as common as James, but maybe Andrew.
It's quite common. Yeah.
Maybe like an Andrew. It's common as that. And so when she wanted to translate hai to American, she just looked up the dictionary.
And she found that.
And she said, oh, ocean. And she saw that, you know, her customers suggested she use ocean when she's talking about the beach. And so she thought it was a very common name, that if she named me Ocean, there would be so many oceans in America. Little did she know it was so strange, you know.
So it was kind of trying to be a little bit anonymous. Maybe.
Yes, because
in your book, you have this beautiful reflection on names. And your name, Ocean, and its boundlessness seems to be in contrast with the name of the protagonist, which is Little Dog. And you say a name thin as air can be a shield, a little dog shield, in the sense that it gives you, being so little, protection and not being exposed.
Yeah.
So is Ocean that kind of protection your mother intended?
It's the dream, you know. And I think it's a working class dream to name your son after something ideal, to name your child after something big and powerful. My friend, the French novelist, Edouard Louis, you know, has a similar background where a lot of working class French, you know, his name was Eddie, to be more American, to be more, to enter the cultural, to have cultural capital, right? There's folks in the Vietnamese community who named their children Simba after the Lion King, you know, to name their children Chanel, Louis Vuitton, you know. These things are common because it's the big dream. You know, there's a friend who had a child named Chevrolet, right? After the car, right? And I think it's very endearing that when you have so little power as a working class parent, maybe you can't even pay the bills. Maybe you can't even buy a gift for your child on their birthday. The one power you have is to rename them. It's the name, which costs nothing. Names are free. And so to me, others might think, oh, so cheesy. Right? It's so corny, cliche, to name your child Destiny, Freedom, Sunshine. But to me, it's actually an incredible moment of power for the parent who is often so powerless to give everything to the name of their child, like Ocean.
Mm. I have to say that I was very much touched by the description of this social origin and the way you managed to express the dignity of any single aspect of that identity, which is not only the Vietnamese origin, the gay background, but especially this social aspect, which you express in such a way which is completely palpable for the reader to feel how this life is very concretely. And that one, these pages were for me one of the best of, mm-hmm. of the whole book. Ocean, we're now closing this wonderful mm-hmm. interview. Thank you so much. One last question, which is a question that everyone will ask you. Mm-hmm. What is the raft of this way of writing about memory being a choice? Is it still open? Is the prose coming? You're a poet, you always stress that you're a poet. I think the poetic strain just follows on. Can it be stopped? But is there a novel? What is there? What do you see? Maybe you don't see anything.
I hope something comes, but I never see my career as a writer as something set. I think the writing of a book is a singular phenomenon. In a way, you finish a book almost bewildered. How did that happen? And writing a book teaches you very little. It doesn't teach you nothing. It teaches you very little about how to write the next one. And going back to Noah's Ark, if you put everything into Noah's Ark, there's nothing left. And I don't, you know, think of my career as a writer as a given, as something that should just continue. I hope it does, but I don't. If I wrote two books and that's it, that's perfectly fine with me. I see myself first and foremost as a teacher. I'm dedicated to being a teacher for the rest of my life, because I know that in my 12 years as a writer, I've garnered enough wisdom to teach writers in their 20s, which is often my students. I have enough to teach them in their 20s for 2 or 3 years that they have with me in the graduate program. But beyond that, I don't see my career as something that continues. I never did. You know, when I wrote the book of poems, I thought, wow, I think that's it. You know, and then luckily, I saw the novel as a way to expand on those questions I asked in the poems. And I said, wow, a novel. But what next right now? Nothing. I'm only excited to live. You write a novel and it's a portal. It sucks you in. And I spent 3 years living only half in this world and half in the novel. And now I get to live fully in this world. And I like to take advantage of that. And I like to just observe. And hopefully through my observations, the impulse to write another book comes. If not, that's okay.
Thank you, Ocean.
Thank you, Piero. Thank you.
Das war es für heute mit dem Podcast Hansa Rauschen. Das waren viele Worte für viele interessante Dinge. Bis zur nächsten Folge und danke fürs Zuhören.